Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V26 Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Visit Lowe's and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 7/9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Well now, back again, are we? Thought a few of you might not make it this time. After last week, I wouldn't have blamed you. Shadows that follow you home, men who deal in wishes with price tags you don't see until it's too late. Those kinds of stories have a way of sticking with you. Some of you might still be wondering what happened to poor Emma, whether those shadows ever truly let her go. And as for the wishing man, well, if you think he's the only one out there waiting to make a deal, you don't know the world nearly as well as you should. But tonight, my friends, tonight, we're diving into something different, something hot. Something that burns deep right down to the bone. Because fire, it's a funny thing, isn't it? It gives warmth, gives life, but it also destroys. It leaves nothing but ash in its wake. Both of tonight's stories were written by Craig Groshuk, and let me tell you, he knows how to bring the heat. Our first tale? It's about sickness, fever, and a man who knows just what to do with a body burning from the inside out. This Is Your Fever Is My Fire, written by Craig Groshuk. Act 1. The fever begins. The fever had been hammering me for 3 days straight. I was too weak to get out of bed, too sore to sleep, and too congested to breathe properly. Every muscle in my body ached. The inside of my throat felt like sandpaper, and my skin burned under a layer of cold sweat. The thermometer blinked back at me, 103.9 degrees Fahrenheit. I should have gone to urgent care. Should have at least tried to force something down my throat, besides sips of lukewarm tap water. But my body felt like a lead weight, and even if I'd had the strength to move, my head swam so badly I doubted I'd make it to the bathroom, let alone the front door. So I just laid there, staring up at my popcorn ceiling while my sheets clung to me like a wet second skin. Then I heard the voice. Pathetic. It rasped from somewhere in my room. I blinked slowly, head lolling toward the doorway. My bedroom was dark, the edges of my vision flickering with a fever dream haze, but I could still make out shapes, the door frame, my dresser, the lamp I hadn't bothered turning on. And him. He was a shape at first, just a crooked silhouette in the corner near my closet, like someone had draped an old coat over a chair. But as my burning eyes adjusted, I saw the shape shift, straighten. And saw the way it breathed. An old man stood there, hunched but solid, with papery skin and deep-set eyes aglowed with something off. His head was bald, save for a few wisps of brittle gray hair, and he smelled like something medicinal, something stale, like an old camphor rub left out too long in the sun. I tried to lift my head, but it was too heavy. Ooh! Wake! He muttered, shuffling toward the foot of my bed. His voice was low, but each word was sharp, cracking like burnt wood. People used to fight through sickness, push through it, but you just lay there, letting it waste you away. I swallowed, or at least I tried to. My throat was so dry, it felt like I was choking. My whole body pulsed with heat, waves of fever rolling through me, making the air swim. A fever dream. It had to be a fever dream. But when I blinked, he was closer. He leaned against the bedpost now, bony fingers curled over the frame. His nails were yellow, cracked like old parchment. This is a good one, you know, he rasped. A good fever. I've waited a long time for one like this. My skin pricked, but it wasn't just from the fever. There was something wrong with the way he stood there, too real for hallucination, too sharp against the blur of my vision. I forced my lips to move, barely managing to croak, "What are you?" The old man's mouth curled into something like a grin. "Someone who knows how to use the fire," he said. "And you're wasting it." I tried to move, to push myself up, but my body refused to obey. "Don't bother," he said, waving a hand. "You're too weak to fight it. Not yet, anyway." He took another step forward, the air shimmering slightly around him, like heat rising off asphalt. His voice dropped to a whisper. "But you could be so much stronger if you let the fire burn hotter." I wanted to tell him to go to hell, but my head lolled to the side, my vision dimming. The last thing I saw before everything went black was the old man watching me, his body standing straighter, his skin looking a little less wrinkled, and the faintest, faintest scent of burning wood in the air. Act 2. Fever Dreams and Firelight. Darkness swallowed me whole. I wasn't sure how long I drifted in. Minutes, hours, days. Time felt thin, stretched out like melted wax. My body floated somewhere beneath me, but I couldn't reach it. I was nothing but heat and exhaustion, drifting through the fever's grip. And then the dream started. I stood in the middle of a vast, endless landscape. The ground beneath my feet was scorched black, cracked like an old riverbed long since dried up. Everything around me shimmered with waves of heat, twisting the air into a rippling mirage. There was no sky, just an angry red glow pressing down from above, like the inside of a furnace. I turned in slow, sluggish motions, my limbs weighed down by exhaustion. In the distance, something flickered. Light? Fire? And then I heard him. "You feel that?" The old man's voice drifted from somewhere close. "That burn in your chest? That heat in your skull?" I turned to find him standing just a few feet away, his posture different now. No longer hunched and brittle, but taller, stronger. His skin, which had been thin and papery before, looked fuller, his eyes sharper. He was still old, but less old, his frame straighter, his hands steadier. "You're burning well now," he said, stepping closer, "not wasting it like before." I took a step back, but my feet barely moved, sinking slightly into the scorched earth. "Where am I?" My voice sounded weak, brittle. "Somewhere between here and there." The old man gestured vaguely to the horizon, where streaks of molten orange pulsed like veins in the cracked ground. "This is what the fever sees." I shook my head, or at least I thought I did. My thoughts were thick, sluggish. "This is just a dream," I whispered. "A fever dream." The old man's smile stretched wide, revealing teeth too white, too straight. "Maybe," he said, "maybe not." The ground beneath my feet shifted. The heat intensified. The air shimmered, bending as flames curled up from the cracks, licking hungrily at my legs. I staggered back. "Stop!" The flames didn't touch me, but they surrounded me, slithering toward me like eager hands. Sweat poured down my face, dripping into my eyes, but I couldn't blink it away. The old man stepped closer, completely unfazed by the fire. "You need to stop fighting it," he said, voice smooth, cajoling. You're wasting your fever. You don't know what it could show you. My breath shuddered. Show me what? His grin widened. Everything. The flames surged, rising higher. I clenched my fist, trying to focus, trying to wake up. But the old man shook his head, tisking like a disappointed teacher. You think cold medicine is going to save you? He sneered. Some stupid pills? You think breaking the fever means you get better? He leaned in, close enough that I could smell his breath, hot and dry, like something burning from the inside out. You don't get better, he whispered. You get through. I wanted to scream, to claw my way back to reality, but my body refused to listen. The fire roared around me, and the old man's form shifted again, his skin tightening, his back straightening, his voice growing stronger. And just before the flames swallowed me whole, I saw his eyes, not old and rheumy anymore, but bright, sharp, and hungry. Act 3. Burn brighter, burn hotter. I woke with a start, sucking in a breath so sharp it stabbed my throat. My body ached, my skin hot enough to feel like it was splitting apart. The fever was worse, so much worse. The room swam around me, light warping at the edges, but I forced myself to move. My sheets were soaked, sticking to my skin like a second layer. My entire bed felt like it had been left out in the sun too long. I turned my head and froze. The old man was sitting in the chair by my bed, not slumped, not frail, stronger, straighter, healthier. He was different now, no longer some brittle husk of a man, but something fuller. His cheeks weren't hollow anymore. His skin had lost that sickly, waxy sheen. He looked almost refreshed, like a man who had a long night's sleep and woke up rejuvenated. Meanwhile, I was falling apart. Ah, he said, smiling. You're finally catching on. My throat worked, but no words came. My body was burning alive. But I couldn't stop staring at him, at the way his fingers curled so confidently against the armrests, at the gleam in his sharper, younger eyes. You're taking it, I croaked. His smile widened. I don't take anything. You're giving it away. I shuddered, trying to sit up, but my arms trembled under my weight. The fever was eating me alive. I had to get help. I had to do something. I lurched toward my nightstand, fumbling for my phone, but my fingers barely worked, clumsy and weak. The screen blurred in my vision. I squinted at the time. 3:12 a.m. Hadn't I checked it earlier? Or was it the night before? How long I had been out? A chuckle from the chair. Hey, you can't run from this, kid. I turned back, and my breath hitching. He was standing now, looming at the foot of my bed. His posture was completely different. No more hunch. No more frail wobbling. His arms were lean, his voice firm, his whole body radiating strength. And me? I felt like I was withering. I don't. My words caught in my throat, my dry throat. I don't want this. He scoffed. You think breaking the fever means you win? No, no. He stepped closer, shaking his head. You haven't earned it yet. There around me wavered, heat curling in the corners of my vision. My whole body clenched, muscles locking up in waves of agony. Let it burn, he said. No, I gasped. He crouched beside my bed, close enough that I could see new color in his cheeks, new strength in his fingers as they curled against the sheets. If you stop now, he murmured, voice almost gentle, all of this suffering will be for nothing. The words twisted inside my fevered brain. I felt them crawl through me, pushing into my ribs, my spine, my skull. Nothing. I was nothing. I had wasted everything. I could barely think, barely breathe, barely... No. I clenched my hands into weak fists, forcing my sluggish mind to push back. He smiled at me like a disappointed father watching a child refuse to swim. "You don't get it," he said. "You were supposed to go further. You were supposed to burn hotter." His eyes glowed, actually glowed, flickering like embers. "Guess I'll just have to help you." And then the room caught fire. Act 4. Breaking the cycle. The fire roared to life around me. Not normal fire. This wasn't something I could put out with a blanket or a glass of water. The walls shimmered, warped, their edges curling inward like paper held too close to a match. The air thickened with heat pressing down on me, smothering me. But nothing burned. Not my bed, not the chair, not the old man. Just me. The fever surged, burning brighter, hotter, devouring me from the inside out. I could feel it licking up my veins, boiling the blood behind my eyes. My skin crawled, like something underneath was cracking open. "Stop!" I rasped, voice barely there. The old man shook his head, smiling. He wasn't old anymore. His skin was smooth, his back straight, his body thrumming with energy he siphoned from me. The brittle husk I'd first seen was gone, and in his place stood something renewed, something alive, something that shouldn't be. "You're almost there," he said, "just a little longer." "No, I had to stop this. I had to break this." My sluggish mind grasped for anything, some way out. Cold. That's what they always said, right? Break a fever with cold, drown it, snuff it out. I forced my body to move. It felt like peeling myself from tar, but I rolled out of bed, hitting the floor in a tangle of burning limbs. My head spun, my vision blackened at the edges, but I crawled, using what little strength I had left to drag myself toward the bathroom. The old man sighed behind me. "Fighting it won't help." I ignored him, gripping the doorframe and hauling myself up. My legs screamed in protest, but I stumbled forward, arms flailing for balance. The tub. I needed the tub. My hands fumbled with the faucet. The old pipes groaned, and for a second, I thought nothing would happen. But then, a rush of icy water blasted from the spout, filling the basin. A sharp chill snapped through my fever-ridden body, like a distant memory of something real, something before all this madness. The old man's reflection rippled in the mirror behind me, his expression twisting. "Don't do that." His voice wasn't mocking anymore. I didn't hesitate. I threw myself into the freezing water. A shock of cold punched through me, the fever screeching as it collided with ice. My body convulsed, lungs seizing, but I forced myself to stay under, stay in the cold, until I felt something snap inside me, like a rubber band stretched too far and finally giving away. A scream ripped through the apartment. Not mine. The old man howled, his voice cracking, splitting apart as his reflection in the mirror blackened, curling at the edges like paper turning to ash. His body, no longer solid, no longer strong, withered, his skin fresh. It was shriveling, his frame collapsing in on itself. "No!" His voice disintegrated, swallowed by the sound of rushing water. And then he was gone. The heat snapped out of the air, vanishing so suddenly that it felt like I'd been dropped into the dead of winter. My fever was gone. My body, though weak and trembling, was mine again. I sank into the cold, my breath hitching in relief. It was over. It had to be. Epilogue. Lingering heat. The next morning, I stood in front of the mirror studying myself. My skin was still pale, my limbs still ached, but the fever, the burning, that was gone. I was okay. I turned to leave the bathroom, but before I stepped out, something flickered in the mirror's corner. I froze. There, just for a second, I swore I saw him. Not as he had been before, but something worse. Charred and blackened, his form barely holding together, his face twisting in silent rage. And then it was gone. I stood there, heart hammering, waiting. The air was cool, the walls were still, the fever was broken. But as I stepped into the hallway, I swore I could still smell the faintest hint of burning wood. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew. Next time I got sick, he'd be waiting. And that, my friends, was Your Fever Is My Fire, written by Craig Groeschuk. Hey, feeling a little warm after that one? Maybe checking your forehead. Well, you should, because that fever might get you not just to be a sickness. It might be something else, something hungry. You ever notice how some folks seem to recover from illness too well? Like they wake up fresh as a daisy while everyone else gets weaker? Maybe they just had a strong immune system. Or maybe they had help. But let's leave that simmering in the back of our minds. Because our next tale, it's about a kind of a fire. The kind that leaves scars. The kind that never really goes out. Some places burn and stay burned. Others, well, they hold on to something. Something that lingers long after the last ember dies. This is We Broke Into Newbridge, written by Craig Groeschuk. Act 1. The Dare. I still remember the way the ruins looked that night. Jagged, blackened stone silhouetted against the moon, like a broken row of teeth. Even now, over 50 years later, I can still smell the ash, feel the rough edges of the foundation beneath my fingers, hear the way the night swallowed every sound. We were 17, too stupid to be scared, too reckless to care. Newbridge Home for Wayward Boys had burned down nearly 2 decades earlier, in 1954. Back then, it was the kind of place they sent kids to that didn't fit in anywhere else. The orphans, the troubled, the ones with no family and no future. And then one night, the whole place went up in flames. The official story, a gas leak. The town whispered a different version. Some said one of the boys set the fire himself, trying to escape whatever horrors went on inside. Others swore the fire started on its own, that it was never meant to be a home, just a holding cell for something that should have been left alone. But no matter what version you believed, the ending was the same. The fire raged for hours, and no one made it out. And after that, people stayed the hell away. Or at least, most people did. I was there because of Richie. Richie had the worst ideas, and Tom and I had the worst habit of going along with them. That night we'd been drinking cheap beer by the train tracks, half watching the cars roll by, when he brought it up. "We should go to Newbridge," he said, grinning. Tom snorted. "To do what? Stand around and look at the pile of bricks?" Richie shook his head, swigging his beer. "No, man, we spend the night. See if it's really haunted." I should have said no. I should have told them both to go to hell and gone home. But I was 17, and the idea of backing out in front of my friends was worse than the idea of spending a few hours in some crumbling ruins. So I shrugged. Why not? Richie whooped, clapping me on the back. Tom groaned, but he wasn't going to be the one to check it out. And just like that, we were going. We hopped the fence around 11 p.m., our flashlights cutting through the dark. Up close, the ruins were bigger than I expected. The main structure long since collapsed, but the outer walls were still standing, like a skeleton picked clean. Richie led the way, climbing over broken bricks and dodging rusted beams. "I don't get why people are so scared of this place," he said. "It's just a bunch of rocks." But it wasn't just a bunch of rocks. Something felt wrong. Not in the way horror movies tell you, where you feel like something's watching you. No, it was worse. It felt like something had been here too long. Like the air was thick with memory, like the fire had burned so hot and so fast that something had been seared into the bones of the place, unable to leave. But I didn't say that. Instead, I cracked open another beer and kept my mouth shut. Tom pointed to the far side of the ruins. "What's over there?" Beyond the rubble, a single doorframe still stood, the charred remnants of the staircase leading downward. "Basement, probably," Richie said. "A place like this would have had one." I shined my light toward the entrance. It didn't make sense. Everyone always said the fire had burned the whole place to the ground, nothing left standing, nothing left to salvage. So why did it look like there was something still down there? Richie grinned. "Guess we should check it out." Tom hesitated. "I don't know, man. Maybe it's not safe." Richie scoffed. "You don't honestly believe all those ghost stories, do you?" I didn't. But I also didn't like the way the basement door looked. I didn't like the way the darkness inside wasn't just shadows. It was thicker, deeper, like the light from my flashlight didn't quite reach. Richie turned back to us. "Come on, what's the worst that could happen?" We followed him down. And that was our first mistake. Act 2. The descent. The stairs groaned under our weight, old wood sagging like it was ready to snap. I gripped the rail for balance, but the second my fingers touched it, it crumbled like charcoal, leaving my hand coated in black dust. Richie laughed. "Better watch your step, Danny. Hate to lose you down there." I didn't laugh back. The deeper we went, the colder it got. The summer night outside had been humid and sticky, but the air down here was stale and untouched, like the fire had never reached this far, which again didn't make sense, because the basement shouldn't have been here at all. At the bottom of the steps, we found ourselves in a long, narrow hallway. The walls were blackened, but not with fire damage. Something else. The stone was too smooth, too dark, as if it had been soaked in something thick and heavy, and I didn't want to think about what. The worst part was the air. It was dead silent. No bugs, no wind, no sound at all, except our breathing, which felt too loud, too close, like the walls were pressing in to hear. Tom swallowed hard. "I don't like this." Richie rolled his eyes. "You never like anything." Still, he wasn't smiling anymore. I moved my flashlight across the hall. Doors lined either side, thick iron handles rusted over. But the wood beneath was untouched, not burned, not warped, not even covered in dust. Like someone had been here, keeping it clean. I stepped closer to one, running my fingers over the surface. The wood was warm. And then something scratched from the other side. We froze. It wasn't loud, just a slow, deliberate scraping of nails dragging against wood, long and patient, like whatever was inside knew we were listening. Richie lifted his hand. "That's just rats." The scratching stopped. Then something tapped back. Tap, tap, tap. Like a child knocking to be let out. Tom whispered, "The rats don't knock, Richie." For the first time, Richie looked unsure. We stood there, waiting, the silence fraying our nerves. Then something laughed. It sounded like a child giggling. And all the blood in my body turned ice cold. "We need to go," I said. Richie hesitated. "But what if?" "Now!" I didn't wait for an argument. I turned and walked, pushing past them toward the stairs. My gut was screaming, "Leave! Leave! Leave!" I was three steps away when I realized something was wrong. The staircase. It was gone. I spun, shining my light up where it had been, where it should have been. But there was nothing. Just a wall of smooth, unbroken stone. Tom made a choked sound. "What the?" I threw myself against the wall, pounding my fists against it. Solid, cold, real. The way out was gone. The hallway stretched on forever, and the doors? One of them was opening. Act 3. The Children in the Dark. The door creaked open slowly, too slowly. The wood didn't scrape against the stone floor. It didn't groan on its hinges. It just opened, soundless, effortless, like something on the other side was pulling it, inviting us in. And then we saw it. The dormitory. The room was untouched by time. It should have been burned to nothing decades ago, but instead it was pristine. Bunk beds lined in neat rows, white sheets folded over thin mattresses, scuffed wooden floors, a single lantern flickering on the nightstand. It looked lived in, like someone had just left. Richie let out a nervous laugh. "I told you, this place isn't haunted. It's just some old fallout shelter or something." Tom shook his head, stepping forward, his flashlight sweeping over the beds. "No," he said, voice barely above a whisper. "This isn't right." Because it wasn't just the beds. There were shoes tucked under the bunk, small and worn, jackets hanging from the bedposts. The walls were lined with old wooden cubbies, each labeled with a name carved into the wood. I stepped closer. The names were familiar. Not from town or school, but from the newspaper clippings. From the list of children who had died in a fire. A bunk creaked behind us. Richie spun, nearly dropping his flashlight. "Did you hear?" Another creak. Tom's breathing turned shallow. "Danny." I turned. Sheets rustled. A bed in the farthest row, one we hadn't even noticed, dipped inward, like someone was sitting up. And then the whispering started. It rolled through the dormitory, dozens of soft voices, overlapping, murmuring, just on the edge of understanding. Not words. Names. Our names. A bunk groaned, the mattress shifting, and something moved in the corner of my eye. A small shape, rising from the sheets. A boy, pale and thin, dressed in soot-streaked nightgown, hair singed at the ends. His head tilted in our direction, but his face was wrong. It wasn't burned or scarred. It was empty. Where his eyes and mouth should have been, there was nothing but a smooth, featureless indent. He twitched like a puppet with broken strings. And then he took a step forward. Richie broke first. He let out a choked yell and bolted for the doorway. Tom and I followed. We sprinted down the hall, feet pounding against stone, breath ripping from our throats, the whispering turning into a chorus of giggles, high-pitched and mocking. I didn't look back. I didn't need to. I could feel them coming after us. The air was colder now, the hall stretching longer, the doors we passed slamming shut one by one. Richard was ahead, reaching out, smacking his hands against the stairwell that should have been there. It wasn't. It was still just a wall. "No, no, no, no," he clawed at it, his voice breaking. I turned, flashlight shaking in my hands. Tom was behind me, chest heaving, and then he stopped breathing. His face went slack, his arms hung at his sides. I whipped the flashlight back toward the hallway and saw two small, pale, bony hands gripping his ankles. Act 4. The escape. Tom wasn't screaming. He wasn't moving. His face had gone slack, eyes unfocused, as though his mind had already drifted somewhere else. His feet were still planted on the floor, but something small and pale gripped his ankles, dragging him inch by inch toward the dormitory door. I lunged forward and grabbed his wrist, pulling as hard as I could. For a moment I felt him resist. Then his head tilted back toward the darkness. A sound escaped his lips. Not a scream, not a gasp, but something else entirely. Something wrong. A laugh, high-pitched and hollow, like it had passed through too many throats before reaching his own. A moment later, I lost my grip. He was yanked backward, disappearing into the open doorway. The door slammed shut behind him, sealing so seamlessly that it looked like it had never been there in the first place. Richie stumbled back, eyes darting between the place where Tom had stood and the featureless wall in front of us. He turned in a slow circle, taking in the empty hall. "Where did he go?" His voice cracked. "Danny, where did he... I ignored him and turned to face the wall that had been replacing the stairwell. It was impossible. The stones fitted together so tightly that not even a sliver of light passed through, but something wasn't right about it. It felt too smooth, too solid, as if the space beyond it had never existed at all. I pressed my palm against it, expecting rough stone, but the surface was strangely cool. Then it shifted. Not physically, there was no crack, no crumble of mortar, but for just a second I swore I saw through it, like it was no more real than a reflection in warped glass. Richie was still panicking, his hands running through his hair, his breaths coming too fast. "Danny, what do we do?" I ignored the question and focused on what I had just seen, or thought I had seen. If the stairwell was still there, if this was some kind of trick, then maybe. I clenched my fist and ran straight at it. Richie shouted my name as I braced myself for impact, expecting pain, expecting bruises, expecting my nose to break against unforgiving rock. But the moment I hit the wall, the world flickered, and I fell through. I hit the ground hard, rolling onto damp earth. For a second, I couldn't breathe. The air outside was sharp and cool against my burning lungs. When I finally forced myself to look up, I found myself staring at the open sky. The ruins stretched around me exactly as we had left them. The moon was still high. The town was still in the distance. I turned to see Richie crumpled on the ground a few feet away. He must have followed me through, though I had no memory of him grabbing me. We were outside. We were free. But Tom was gone. Richie sat up and stared at the ruins, his face pale. His lips parted, but no words came out. I didn't speak either. There's nothing to say. We stood up and left without looking back. Epilogue. What was left behind? We never told anyone. Not the cops, not our parents. What could we say? That Tom had vanished into a room that didn't exist? That the stairwell had been gone one moment and there the next? That something in that basement had let us go but kept him? No one would believe us. So we did what scared kids do. We ran. A week passed before people started asking questions. Tom's parents filed a missing persons report. The whole town turned out for the search. His face ended up on flyers. The police questioned everyone who knew him, including Richie and me. We told them we didn't know anything. It wasn't a lie, not exactly. We had no idea where he was. We only knew where he wasn't. Not in town, not in the woods, not anywhere they thought to look. They scoured the ruins of Newbridge, but the only thing they found was a foundation of burnt-out bricks and old stone. No basement, no staircase, no way in. Richie and I never spoke about that night again, not to each other, not to anyone. We went on with our lives, finished high school, moved out of town. Decades passed. I settled somewhere new, started a career, built a family. But some nights, when I can't sleep, I hear things. The creak of old wooden beds shifting under weight, the sound of bare feet against stone, and sometimes, just before I drift off, I swear I hear my name. I tried not to think about Newbridge. I tried to convince myself it was all in my head. But a few days ago, I saw a news article. They're redeveloping the ruins. Some local group is turning it into a historical landmark, a tribute to the boys who lived and died there. They don't know what's still down there. They don't know what happens when you open doors that were meant to stay closed. They don't know that, once the digging starts, they're going to hear laughter. And it won't be coming from above. It'll be coming from below. And that, my friends, was We Broke Into Newbridge, written by Craig Groschek. You know, some places shouldn't be disturbed. Some doors shouldn't be opened. And yet, folks never seem to learn. They dig, they poke, they prod. And for what? A story? A thrill? Proof that something was there? Well, Danny and Richie got their proof, and Tom? Well, we know where he isn't. And now they want to rebuild it, turn it into a memorial, a historic landmark, a place for tourists. But what happens when they dig too deep, when they find the staircase that shouldn't exist, when they hear the laughter coming from below? You know, I think we should all keep an eye on the news for that one. Just in case something new starts disappearing. In Newbridge. So there you have it. Two stories, two warnings. One about what happens when your own body turns against you, and one about what happens when you disturb something that was never meant to be found. Either way, fire doesn't just burn away the past. Sometimes it leaves you something. Now, as always, I leave it to you. Maybe these are just stories. Maybe they're just old legends passed down and twisted over time. But then again, maybe some stories are warnings. And maybe, just maybe, those warnings are real.